Good morning, world travelers and diners. You're listening to On the Menu.
We better mention drinkers, too, today.
Well, drinkers today, because we have a lot of liquid.
it's a liquid program, and even though the last segment of the program isn't about beverages, it's certainly liquid, as you'll find out.
Yes. Anyhow, you're listening to On the Menu.
Oh, we forgot that.
Yes.
We forgot that.
We're listening. Did we say Ann and Peter Haig?
No, we forgot that.
Okay. Well, anyhow, we are set up for a liquid.
Ann and Peter Haig are very confused because it's just after Thanksgiving, and we just saw our beautiful granddaughter once again. So it's been pretty exciting. But now we're back, just like all of you are too, and we hope you didn't eat too much, and we hope you made turkey soup and all that kind of good stuff. But this is several very interesting beverage-related things, and we always like to do different things. So we've got beer to start with, followed by wine, followed by bourbon, which sounds like quite a lineup to me. First up, a beverage which invented lager beer, golden lager beer. 166 years ago is my recollection, but you'll hear that in the interview. In Pilsen in Czechoslovakia, somebody discovered a way to make beer in a whole new and exciting way, and they've been making it that way ever since. That's Pilsner Raquel, and here's our interview about it.
Ryan Johnson's official title is Trade Brewmaster, which sounds like a kind of an intriguing job in and of its own right. So we'll have to ask him to explain that a little bit later in our conversation. But Ryan works for MillerCoors, which is a modern combination of two traditional longtime American brewers, but that's not the reason we're here today. We're here today to talk about a birthday, a very special birthday for a beer that's 166 years old. Ryan?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
How are you?
That was not so well for this interview.
That was a good cue. I gave you the cue, and I thought I'd give you the cue, and you were still waiting for me. That's all right.
Well, it actually broke up. I actually got some static. I didn't think I was.
Oh, is that what happened?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, all right. Well, in that case, it's my fault. Basically, I wanted you to explain what this 166th birthday is about, and
yeah, absolutely.
What the beer is. Go for broke.
No problem. On October 5th, 1842, 166 years ago, Pilsner Raquel was brewed in the Pilsen, Czech Republic. This beer actually changed the way the entire world saw beer, because for the first time, beer was golden. And back then, anything golden was considered very, very beautiful. And it was a very special moment, because up until that point, all beer was cloudy and murky and dark.
Oh, okay, so when you say golden, you mean a very clear color and a much brighter, paler color than people had seen before.
Yeah, exactly. And if you ever hold up a Pilsner Raquel to the light, it actually is a very similar color to really rich gold, almost like a 24-karat gold color. And that really was special then, because for the first time, they were able to see a beer that had this color, and at the same time, glassware became mechanized. So people were actually able to use glassware for the first time. Before that, typically glassware was reserved for royalty.
So before that era, you had the traditional steins made out of clay pottery.
That's right. The
famous in German beer gardens.
Absolutely.
So it was an advance on that to have glass.
Mm-hmm.
And what was it? Something special that the Pilsner Urquell, I noticed you said, was there some special kind of chemistry they developed, or?
There was a few things that happened. First of all, there was a new malting process that was available where they could actually dry the barley without adding a smoked flavor to it. Typically, before that point, malting barley was a process where in the drying part of the malting process, they actually used wood and different things that they burned, and obviously that smoke flavor would add on to the beer flavor. But then they developed a way to actually develop malt where it was steam dried or air dried, and it kept that smokiness out of the flavor. And not to mention, we also used a very unique brewing process that enabled us to, it's called triple decoction brewing, that enabled us to basically draw out all the process, the brewing process, the flavor profiles, the aromas that Joseph Grohl, our initial head brewer for Pilsner Urquell, was looking for. He really had a great vision in that he, I think he could taste the beer before he made it. And he brought all these things together at the ripe age, old age of 29 and was able to develop this beer that basically changed the way beer is brewed all over the world. This beer actually represents the original beer that up to 90%, arguably, of all beer consumed on planet Earth is a direct descendant of this beer.
Okay, so
I didn't even know it was named after a place.
Pilsen.
Urquell actually means from the original source.
Oh, no
if
kidding.
You look at the old world German root of Urquell.
Now, if you
Pilsner, that is a style of beer, right? And and it's also a style of glass. So this is a very momentous event, huh?
Now, what would be the difference between a Pilsner and a lager? Is that an artificial difference, or is there really a difference?
That's a great question. I mean, Pilsners are lagers.
Okay.
There are arguably between 15 and 20 judgeable lager styles in the world.
Okay.
And then there's ales. So everything is either an ale or a lager.
Okay.
Ales are a lot bigger category.
Now I'm following you. In my traditional British upbringing, of course, mostly what we drank were ales. And then, no. Girls drank lager.
Yeah, well, lagers are typically a lot cleaner, crisper, drier, easier drinking beers. Ales are typically a lot bigger, more flavorful, more fruity. When you talk about stouts and porters and pale ales, these big beers, those are all ale styles.
But let's get a little bit controversial here. I mean, the first time I tasted American beer, it was actually Budweiser, and a neighbor who was over in London on a U.S. Navy contract gave me a case of Budweiser for Christmas. It turned out my wife was in the hospital because she was expecting a baby, so I'm at home. And this beer was so light, I used to drink it for breakfast.
Mm-hmm. Good God.
And it was called a lager beer. Take Pilsner Urquell as a comparison. Pilsner Urquell is a hugely flavorful, positively bursting with hoppy flavor.
Yeah, I mean, if you go back to the original part of your question, that's a very interesting way to look at it. You know, Budweiser actually is 5% alcohol plus. It's actually really strong. There's actually a lot of ales in England that are actually less alcohol than Budweiser actually
is. I'm talking about the flavor.
Oh, yeah, certainly.
The taste, or shall we say, the lack thereof.
Well, I won't comment on Anheuser-Busch products.
You might be risking your job just a little bit, so I understand completely.
All beer is good beer. It just depends on the occasion in which we drink it, right?
There we go. I had a friend in Australia who said that. He said there's no such thing as bad beer. It's all good. It's just some is better than others.
Yeah, and I really think it's important for everybody to start thinking about beer on the occasion in which we drink it. You know, if it's 105 degrees outside, maybe a Miller Lite is going to taste a lot better to somebody than a big, heavy stout. You know, so it's hard to say which beer is better. You really have to define the occasion.
Now, the remarkable thing, and we were talking about this before I went on the air because I wanted to be sure this was correct, the Pilsner Urquell is still brewed in the same place it was brewed 166 years ago. It's fully imported into the United States and other countries where it's sold. Has it changed over the years?
I would say that it hasn't changed. I mean, I've been drinking it for quite some time. I actually think the quality has improved dramatically over the last 5 years here in the United States. But the process had to change because we went from brewing for, you know, 7 or 8 countries to brewing for the entire world. So any brewery that has grown over the last, 50 years, let alone 150 plus years, has had to modify the way they brew beer just in order to keep up with demand.
Okay.
So obviously we've had to update the brewery. But a really cool thing about Pilsner, and one of the reasons why I really have always had a great respect for the beer, is that we actually have a process called the parallel brewing process, where we actually brew beer in the exact same way that we did in 1842 on a regular basis, and we actually test our beer now from the bigger brewing system to the beer that's brewed in the parallel brewing process to make sure that they're exactly the same.
So the original brewery is still going strong, and that's the one you call the parallel brewery.
That's exactly right.
Okay, now other people doing it the same way? I mean, there's a huge worldwide brand that I'm very familiar with, and I'm sure you are too, called Guinness, that's been brewed for probably almost as long as Pilsner or Quell. Are they doing the same thing?
You know, I'm not sure. I would assume because of the fact that the Guinness Brewery has been very, very big for a very long time. At one time, the Guinness Brewery in Dublin was the largest brewery in the entire world. So they've probably been, you know, they started big, you know what I mean?
Yes.
So they probably haven't had to change much process. But I know Guinness is going through quite a bit of changes right now with trying to decide where to put up the brewery and, and you know.
Well, they have several. I mean, they have one in London, although they don't say that very much. They used to have one in Nigeria, of all places. So they went the route of saying we can reproduce the brewing process somewhere else. We were talking before we came on the air about overseas recipes, like Indian Kingfisher, for example, was one I use as an example, which are being brewed under license in the United States. And it doesn't seem to me that they're anything like the same.
Yeah, you know, when we talk about Guinness being brewed all over and the reproducibility of that beer, ales are typically a lot easier to brew than lagers.
Okay, all right.
So it's very, very easy to actually, to me, stouts. I've been brewing my whole life, and it's really, really easy to make a stout. Not taking anything away from Guinness being one of the most beautiful beers in the world, but stouts, porters, pale ales, all these beers are very, very simple to make as opposed to some of these really fine, subtly complex Pilsner-style lagers.
Now, why is that? What makes it harder?
Well,
I mean, without needing to give us a quick course in brewing.
No. The easiest way to describe it is that if you make a subtle mistake in an ale, it's hidden by the fact that the beer's flavor is so intense.
Okay.
You cannot make the single slightest mistake, even in like domestic lagers from Miller Lite all the way up to Pilsner or Quell, because that mistake is very, very obvious. And that's why I really have a ton of respect for domestic U.S. brands, because to make them on that volume and make every single drop exactly the same is something that is absolutely brilliant to me.
Well, but it's remarkable that you say that you think Pilsner Urquell is better now than it ever was. Remarkably, it's brewed in the same place, although the brewery is a whole lot bigger. It's been through all kinds of history. A couple of world wars, a period of Cold War repression under the Soviet bloc, when I guess somehow or other Pilsner Urquell must have gotten out, because that's when I started drinking it for the first time. But it's a wonderful thing that this is still with us, and I would say you would be the first to tell us that the brand is secure, and more and more people should find out about it.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those beers that I think is an acquired taste. People that really like beer and really enjoy beer, this is a perfect beer for them.
Well, you must be having a good time now that the beer popularity is on the rise, and we're now getting invitations to beer dinners, matching beer to food. So you're on the rise, as I said.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually spend most of my time developing beer and food pairing content.
Oh, really?
Executing these beer dinners, training internally and externally on beer and food and beer intrinsics. So it is a very good time. And I think that this time around in the United States that it's here to stay. Before we've had craft beer movements, we've had better beer movements, and they plateaued and then flattened out and then declined. I think this time around, we're going to see a dramatic change, and I really think it's being driven by the fact that the breweries are acting together to push the entire beer category.
Oh, that's it. I wonder.
Each other.
It's not consumer-driven, then. It's actually marketing-driven.
Well, it is consumer-driven, too, because I think what's really happening is that consumers are becoming very, very educated, and I think that has a lot to do with the Internet. And if you're going to spend money on anything these days, consumers really want to know what it is they're spending their money on. So through education, we've really helped you know, raise the awareness of what beer is and what good beer is, and really how to make a lot of occasions. Used to be, you know, beer was something you'd have on a hot day, baseball game with a hot dog.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, there's thousands of different beers with all these crazy ingredients, and they, you know, to me, beer can battle wine any day of the week. You know, there's a lot of wine people that would freak out when they hear that. But I've done actually a lot of competitions and shows with wine sommeliers and pairing, and nine times out of ten, I win.
The thing is, it's so filling for and heavy for to pair with food, isn't it?
Well, it just depends on what beer you're drinking. Mm-hmm. And it also depends on how you dispense the beer. If you drink a beer straight out of the bottle, what you're doing is you're consuming that CO2 without ever letting it have a chance to decant. I like to use the word decant because people understand what I'm saying.
Oh, that's good.
Well, this is the last piece of good advice. So beer is intended to be poured out of the container into a glass.
Absolutely.
Well, I never realized. That was I thinking I was saving washing up.
No. Into a beer clean glass. Make sure that the glass has been rinsed free of all soaps and sanitizers.
Of course.
That is absolutely more, it's actually more important than it is with wine. See, wine is so high in ethanol, at 14%, that it's actually pretty good
at washing it off.
Exactly. And with beer, protein stability is the key to a good beer. And if you break those proteins down with soaps and sanitizers, then you're never going to experience the beer as the brewer intended.
Well, I tell you what.
I've learned a ton. I mean,
listeners, this has been a history lesson. This has been a political lesson. This has been a lesson in drinking. Ryan, thank you so much for joining us. And listeners, get yourself some Pilsner Urquell or Urquell, depending on how you like to pronounce it. And there's still time to raise a toast to something that's been going to for 166 years, and I'm sure it's going to go another 166 at least. Ryan, thank you so much for joining us today.
And happy birthday.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
And now it's time for us to take what we sometimes call a pause for the cause.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. We always insert our email address at this point, and I guess I might as well do it again. It's on the menu at onthemenuradio.com, and we'd love to hear from you.
And, of course, our new blog, On the Menu Radio, at blogspot.com, where we're a little lonely and we need your help to make sure that it becomes a good blog. So do join us there. And in the meantime, let's go on. We started with beer. Now we're going to go on with wine and an excellent companion for someone who's either, everywhere, I think, from a neophyte to a real enophile, a real expert on wines, would gather useful information from a wonderful new book that just arrived at our doorstep called Wine Wise.
It's a good book. Steve Colpan, I got that one. You say people have trouble with your name, but no, it's a wonderful name. And you've attached it to a wonderful book called Wine Wise. My first question has to be, why another book on wine?
That's a very good question. We thought there was a need for a book that really spoke to the consumer in a very easy to understand language, and at the same time give him or her as much confidence and knowledge as they wanted to develop in order to further appreciate wine. I mean, we're great believers that you don't have to have a deep understanding of wine to enjoy it, but we also believe that having a basic understanding can make it more enjoyable, and that was the attempt of this book. You know, we've written other books that are more technical.
And you might explain your co-authors.
Yes, I'm sorry, that's Brian Smith and Michael Weiss.
Right.
We all teach at the Culinary Institute of America. And, you know, we've written this book, Exploring Wine, which is a huge book, a huge tome that's used as a textbook for wine courses all over the world. But we wanted to do a consumer-based book called, and that's WineWise, because we felt there was a need to address basic needs of consumer for their knowledge and further enjoyment of wine. And we just happened to, our last chapter is a chapter on bargain wines, which came out just as the economy was falling apart.
Huh.
And this seems to have been getting a lot of attention, and we're getting a lot of feedback about that.
Now, let's give our listeners an idea of the structure of this book, which if Exploring Wine is a tome, WineWise isn't real shy either. I'm holding it in one hand with some difficulty.
Well, it's a substantial book, but it's, you know, it just happens to have a hard cover on it. We debated whether or not it should be a paperback. But the book is divided into sections that has to do with basic knowledge about wine, and then we go to the major countries that produce wine, both in the old world, Europe, and the new world, you know, the United States, Canada, and then South Africa, Chile, Argentina, Australia, New Zealand. But we certainly pay attention to France, Spain, Italy, and we have sections on the two up-and-coming countries that we identify are Canada and Greece in terms of...
Yeah, isn't that amazing with Greece? Yeah. Greek wines are coming along.
Well,
they're terrific.
I think Canada's probably more amazing as being a sort of a non-traditional producer, except for the wines that came from the Great Lakes region. But I'm guessing that now most of the best wines are coming from the western part of Canada?
Well, there are two basic sections in Canada. One is in Ontario,
okay,
where 80% of the wine comes from.
Okay.
And then some of the best wines, but only 20% of the industry, is located in British Columbia,
right,
on the West Coast.
Right. So it's sort of like a northern extension of Oregon and Washington.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And it's, you know, a cool climate region, so some great Riesling. And Canada is actually the largest producer of ice wine in the world.
Yeah.
Okay, now you start out by an introduction that says, essentially this book is about how to enjoy wine. It's not how to know everything there is to know about
exactly
it. It's,
right.
It's how to make sure that you know what you're getting into. And I'm guessing that you can dig about as deeply as you want into the rest of the book. But the rest of the book, then, the structure is an introduction to vines, both white and red, based on the major grapes.
Right.
And then you go regionally. To California, Washington, Oregon, New York. You don't include Virginia, where we recently did a wine tour, but I'm sure there's a good reason why, because it's much
In this book, we're just doing the major producers. In Exploring Wine, we have a section on Virginia.
Oh, okay. Oh,
there isn't a chapter heading.
No.
Now, Exploring, it's a big book. The Exploring Wine, the big town, the textbook.
Oh, I see. And then you get into living with wine as an approach as well. So, do you want to take an example of the structure of maybe one of the major white grapes and let listeners know what they might find?
Okay. Well, for example, we do break the chapter on grapes up into white grapes and red grapes. And each chapter is called Great Vines Make Great Wine. And, for example, if we take, I guess, the most likely grape would be Chardonnay, and we talk about the profile of Chardonnay, what it contributes to a wine, how it grows as a grape, the best regions for growing it, best kinds of soils, then the classic regions where it grows in France, which, of course, for still wines would be Burgundy, and for the sparkling wines would be Champagne. We talk about where it grows in the United States and in Canada. We talk about and what kind of wines it produces. We talk about where it grows in the Southern Hemisphere, South America, Argentina, Australia, New Zealand, etc. The rest of the world, obviously, anyone who's making wine these days is making Chardonnay, whether they're in Hungary or China. Which, by the way, is now the sixth largest wine producer in the world.
Now, tell me about that. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true.
Where are they growing?
Is it any good?
There are a few good wines that I've tasted. I've tasted some not-so-good wines, too.
I mean, we just read the article today about the brown clouds suffocating all the agriculture in China.
Yeah.
So, and then when you go on to talk about wines, you have real labels.
Yes.
And I'm looking at a page 216,
okay,
called The Language of the Label.
Right, and we try to explain. We explain what the label means. So when you look at the label, you'll understand who the producer is, what the place is, where the wine comes from, or what grape it's grown from, the region that it's in, and obviously the country.
And you're not shy. I turned to a Spanish page, and on page 219 is a list of some of the best wine producers. So you're not shy about offering up an opinion, and I think that's
the way. And actually the book is quite opinionated. And I think people want that. I mean, you know, each of us has been doing this at least 20 years, so, you know, we have something to say. And we have tasted wines from great producers all over the world. We've met a lot of the producers, too. We've been fortunate enough to do that. And so, yeah, we do list some of the best producers.
And listeners, here's a place you can go where you can get an informed opinion in a relatively short words on whether or not wine should have corks or whether wine should have screw caps.
Right.
And I think you come down heavily in favor of screw caps.
I would say in the current technological rate that we're at now, the screw caps are the much better closure.
So there's a little bit of everything here.
Right.
How would you imagine that someone would use the book? I mean, it's not a book you would read from cover to cover. It's a book you would refer to.
I think people would use it. They might go out, buy a bottle of wine, bring it home, and then they might want to read a little bit about it, or the place that it comes from, or the grape home. And, you know, that might encourage them to do some more reading. But we certainly don't expect people to sit down use it as a page-turner. I think we really like to see it as a book that can really be used as people enjoy their wine and learn a little bit more about it.
Now, how did you get involved with wine?
Ah, wow, so long ago. I always liked wine. I actually got involved myself with wine by writing about it. I was writing for magazines and newspapers, small venues. And I was writing about movies and art and media and some
of the... In what part of the country?
New York.
Oh, so you're in New York.
Someone said, there's a wine tasting. Does anybody know about wine? I said, well, I like wine. They said, that's good enough. You go. And I realized that there was a lot to learn. And I was, you know, my mid-20s, late-20s at the time. So I realized there was a tremendous amount to learn. And I actually started writing more about wine, learning about wine, traveling. I was a sommelier for a while. I was teaching writing. And so I had this teaching background, and eventually a lot of things came together, and I ended up teaching wine at the Culinary Institute of America.
Right.
But at the time that I got involved in wine, there were very few formal wine classes.
Well, what is the program that CIA like now?
Well, we have two different levels of courses. For the basic associate's degree, it's a mandatory class in wine. It's 3 weeks. It's 6 hours a day. You taste about 100 wines over the course of the 3 weeks.
Palate fatigue.
Pardon me?
Palate fatigue.
Well, the students seem to take to it. Some students do, you know, we tell them you should stop if your palate gets tired. Mm-hmm. But the students seem to be able to do it. We do it through about 13 different tastings. And we do wine and food pairing as well, of course. And so the whole idea is to make them knowledgeable about wine and how it interacts with food, and the fact that wine is itself a food. It just happens to be in a glass, just happens to be fermented. But it is something that adds, that enhances any dish that you're going to be serving in a restaurant, any dish that you're creating in the kitchen.
Now, I just turned to another section in the book, wine tasting. Do try this at home. The book is full of different ways of exploring wine,
right.
And you make some things very clear, like use wine glasses. Don't use clear plastic cups, which make the wine taste like clear plastic cups.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. And we mentioned that, you know, if you don't have a good selection of wine glasses at home, I think it's surprisingly inexpensive to go to one of these rental places and rent a rack of wine glasses.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think that we can really recommend this book to our readers, our listeners, because it's so helpful, absolutely amazingly helpful.
Well, that's the idea. We wanted
That's what you did. You made it helpful.
We wanted it to be helpful for the average reader and someone who's just kind of getting their tongue wet with wine, I guess.
And in the back of the book, listeners, Steve and his two co-authors list their recommendations for bargain bottles under $10 or $12 and bargain bottles under $20.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a guide for what to go look for.
Yeah, hundreds of wines.
At your local liquor store.
Right.
And I guess you must have drunk them all, huh?
Yes, we have.
I think it was, who was it? She was talking about spitting backwards.
There was an
author whose book we read, I think Leslie Sobraga or something like that.
Yeah,
and we said, how can you recommend these wines? You couldn't possibly have tasted them all. And she said, I have, and a whole lot more.
Yeah, well, that's true, a small smattering of what we taste.
And I guess you must have done the same thing. There's a great index at the back. I'm delighted to know that Robert Parker is only mentioned once.
Poor man. I mean, everybody's
reference. Basically, the message of this book is to trust your own palate, not anybody else.
Not the point system.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
And, last thing is, why is it all of a sudden we have a lot of women studying wine and becoming sommeliers?
Well, I think women have excellent palates. I think that women seem to be able to identify when they taste. They're very good at working with their memory. And it's been actually proven in tests scientifically that when women taste, they move back to a memory, whereas men feel they have to say something quantifiable.
Uh-huh.
And I think that it's a reflection of what we see throughout the rest of the society. We see women in all different jobs and careers, and I think that this is one that is exciting for either a man or a woman. But I also feel that women can be they feel freer to articulate and to share their knowledge of wine. That's what I've noticed. I've been teaching students for 20 years, and what I've noticed is that the women seem absolutely more receptive to sharing their knowledge, which I think is very important for someone who's going to be a sommelier or dealing with the public, dealing with wine.
We just had a recent experience, Steve, that you might be interested in. We were at one of the best restaurants in northern Spain near San Sebastian, and there was a very elegant, very sophisticated Oriental young lady who was in this part of northern Spain for reasons we never quite figured out, but her email address is Wine Goddess.
Yeah, sure.
And wouldn't you know, we found out that she worked at a restaurant in Australia
that we liked.
Where we knew the sommelier, and the sommelier was also a young lady.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Just to cap it off, here's a fun story for you. I'd like your reaction to this one. We were at a very fine restaurant in New York. The chef had invited us. He had prepared a special menu for us, but he forgot to tell the sommelier. So around the time we were ordering some wine, I said, I think you better go figure out what chef's gonna serve us.
She was also female.
So she went off. She came back 2 minutes later, and she said, I've agreed with Michael that the only thing I can do is serve you a white and a red with each course.
Yeah.
Which she did, and it was the most fun. And,
well, that's what we do in our class when we do our food and wine luncheon. We serve a white and a red with each three courses.
Uh-huh.
We had a few more courses than that.
Yeah, no, I
And that's a good way probably to end the story. This is a book that belongs on your bookshelf or next to your wine cellar, wherever you'd like to keep it, because you'll find it an invaluable reference. It's called Wine Wise. Steve Copen, thank you so much for talking to us. And please give our best wishes to Brian and Michael as well.
I will. Thanks.
Thank you so much for joining on the menu.
Okay. Bye-bye.
And now it's time for another break.
And we'll talk to you on the other side, of course.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, moving right along from beer to wine and now to bourbon. And I must say that just the fumes from all these bourbons, the fumes made me woozy.
Yeah, we should quickly explain, listeners, that we caught up with Fred Booker, spokesperson for
wonderful character,
spokesperson for Jim Beam and their wide range of small batch bourbons, taking over that role from his father, who we'd met before. I called him bourbon royalty on our website because his family's been in the business for so many centuries, almost since bourbon was invented. And he still talks about it as if it's as exciting as it was the first day that he ever got up and had a sip. So Frederick Bucarneau joined us at the Pittsburgh Whiskey Festival recently, and here he is telling the story.
On the menus at Pittsburgh Wine Festival, second event, and we have somebody I call royalty in the bourbon business. When I put a note on the website that some of you might have seen, because there's not much doubt that larger-than-life personalities called Bucarneau have a rather dominant position in the American bourbon business, since they founded a family business called Jim Beam just, I don't know exactly how many years ago. I'm going to ask Frederick Bucarneau III, who I'm talking to this evening, to give us a little bit of that history.
Family started making whiskey in 1795. I'm the seventh generation Beam family member to be involved in this business. We've been doing it for well over 200 years now, and I think we know what we're doing. This process has been passed down from generation to generation. You know, my father, Bucarneau, he developed Malbatch Bourbon Collection. When he hit 70 years old, he stepped back away from traveling and talking about the product, turned it over to me. And now I've been doing this for about 11, 12 years now.
Now,
25 years, so it's what we do.
We met Booker 25 years ago, and he was one of the funniest guys I ever met. And somebody asked him, how long have you been tasting single-barrel bourbon? And he said, I've been doing that my whole life, and I guess you're doing the same thing, right?
Oh, yes, sir. It's, you know, people always ask when I had my first taste of bourbon. And I explained it back when I was a little boy or a baby. Mothers, when you're cutting the teeth, would stick their finger into a little bit of whiskey, bourbon, and rub the gum. So I guess bourbon crossed my lips when I was a little bitty guy. And it's been in my blood ever since.
And you select it barrel at a time, right?
Oh, yeah. I do the selection of the barrels for the small batch bourbon, the Booker's bourbon. You know, we actually are a small batch bourbon. We mingle 200 barrels together to make a batch. Dad's theory on that was for consistency. We'd mingle together the best barrels in the rack house to be more consistent every time you pick up a bottle. It'd be as close to the same flavor as we can get it.
That applies to the main Jim Beam brands as well, or is that just the single batch?
Oh, yeah, no, we do the Jim Beam as well. We dump barrels together. Dad was never a fan of single barrel, per se, where you pour one barrel out, process it, bottle it, and go back and get another barrel. He likes to mingle together best barrels that we have for a consistency to be the best we can do every time we actually put a bottle out on the market.
And I remember asking somebody at a Scotch distillery once how the blenders figured out what went together, and they said, that's a secret we can't tell you, so I'm guessing you can't tell us that either.
Oh, it's not really a secret. You just sit down, you sip and smell and, you know, and just taste it. Get a taste in your mouth and in your mind that you enjoy, and you look for that taste in the barrel. You mingle the barrels together, and then once you get that flavor, then you dump it out. And that's when you mingle those barrels together.
Now, when you're making this fine quality whiskey, it stays, after it's blended, does it stay in the barrel for longer?
Oh, after when we dump the barrels, we do our mingling after they are dumped out. Then it goes into the bottle. Barrels, when we put it away, it stays in the same spot during the aging. Then after aging is when we do our mingling and blending together.
So you call it mingling, but other people would call it blending.
The reason, you know, we get into the dad was big on the mingling. When you start talking about blending, people tend to think about blended whiskey. You know, and blended whiskeys are colors and flavors added. You know, a lot of grain neutral spirit. Bourbon, we can't add any colors or flavors. There's no grain neutral spirits added. We're just taking barrels, mixing them together, or mingling them together, marrying them together to make the final product.
Now, the finer whiskeys stay in the barrels for longer?
Oh, yes, sir. Age greatly affects the product. I mean, start looking at the small batch bourbons, they're extra 8 to 9, 10 years in the barrel. Bottled a little higher proofs, like the Booker's. It's uncut, unfiltered, bottled straight from the barrel. It'll be anywhere from 124 to 128 proof. The reason Dad developed that bourbon at that strength was to let the consumers cut it to the strength they want to drink it themselves. Take a bottle of water or put it on the rocks and swirl it around, and then the proof, as it comes down, gets down to the way you like it. And what Dad always preached, and I've continued to do so, is if taste the bourbon and make a face, it's too strong.
Now, what's the right additive for drinking bourbon properly? Is it water? Is it rocks? What should it be?
Oh, that's totally up to the individual. I mean, if you enjoy ice, that's fine. If you enjoy water, that's fine as well. My mother, she prefers ginger ale. with a little splash of ginger ale. I never saw my dad tell her not to do it that way either. I mean, whatever you like. If you like a little splash of a soft drink, it's okay. I mean, there's no reason you can't mix the bourbon any way you want to.
Now, I did have a question that I don't think I ever asked Booker. I didn't have a chance, so I've got you to ask. Scotch whiskey aged for, in some cases, a very long time, 50, 60 years. Bourbon isn't aged for nearly that long. Why is that?
There's actually several factors that come into play when you start looking at that question of aging. Number one, you know, we're using new barrels for bourbon. That is the law. The Scotch distillers, they're using used barrels. You know, a used barrel, you know, the caramelized layer, we've already softened up the wood quite a bit. A lot of them are reusing bourbon barrels. The next thing is, you know, they're using a barley-based product, which is a different than bourbon is a corn-based product. Probably one of the biggest factors that comes into play are the differences in climate. When you look at the temperature range in Kentucky, you know, we will touch 100 degrees in the summer, and we will go down to 0 degrees in the winter. Scotch distilleries, they never see 100 degrees in the summer, and they may get down close to zero in the winter, but not having that hot summer slows the aging down considerably, because you're not driving the liquor into that wood as deep.
So at about 7 or 8 years in new oak barrels, that's as good as it's going
to
get.
Well, you can take it a little bit more now. You can get maybe up to 10 or 12 before it starts picking up too much wood. But you know, when I've talked with a lot of the Scotch distillers over the years at different events, much like here at Pittsburgh, after we'll get finished, we'll be around, you know, sitting, maybe enjoying a whiskey together. And we've kind of come up with a mathematical formula that kind of goes 1 year in Kentucky in a new barrel is like 3 to 5 years in Scotland in a used barrel. So when you start looking at the aging, you know, a 20-year-old Scotch, you know, you start dividing it by three, well, that's like a 6-year-old bourbon. You take a 9-year-old bourbon, multiply it times three, that's 27. So, I mean, our aging is not, if you really do the mathematics, put it together like you should, we're really pretty close year to year.
So it's sort of a little bit like dog ears and cat ears.
Exactly.
Now, are you still selling those wonderful old barrels to use as barbecue chips?
Oh, yes, sir. We sell barrels there at our facility. There's actually one outfit that buys our barrels and grinds them up and can buy bags of these barbecue chips to smoke your meat and stuff on the grill.
Yeah, we found out about that from your mother.
Right.
Because we asked, we said we have these McElhenney pepper barrels. I wish we had bourbon barrels. She said, oh, we do those. We'll send you some. And we were just delighted to get those. How's she doing? She doing well?
Mom's still doing well. She's still living right there in the same place. Hadn't moved. She's her and Dad's little dog Dot are still carrying right on. It's like it's always been. She's doing well.
Now, you do drink Scotch, I'm guessing, because you said earlier on you'll get together with your colleagues at this wonderful event and try some of theirs. Do you have a special favorite?
Oh, I kind of like the Highlands Scotch. You know, some of our the Dalmore is one that grown pretty. Pretty accustomed with Richard Patterson, the master blender at the Dalmore. He's a good friend of mine, and he's taught me a lot about Scotch over the years. I'm acquiring a taste for the Isle of Scotch. We recently acquired the Lefroy Distillery. So we're John Thompson, the blender and distiller from Lefroy. He's trying to educate me on the finer points of the Isle of Scotch. Now it's a little different than the Highland Scotch, but I'm getting there. I'm getting there.
It's very peaty because the water in that part of Scotland, I don't know if you've seen it, the water is almost the color of bourbon anyway in its natural state.
That's what John was telling me. It was funny, the first time he gave me a taste, he said, what do you taste? Or what do you smell? And I said, Band-Aid. And then he quoted me later. I said, John, you weren't supposed to tell everybody what I said, but he said, you know, Scotch is, you know, from that area, people love them or hate them. And, you know, at first, I didn't appreciate it, but now it's getting where I kind of understand what it's all about. And I appreciate what they do. They do a good job.
Well, that's wonderful. Now, here's a name for you. Michael Jackson. The other Michael Jackson.
Right.
Are you a friend of his? Oh, I mean, I guess he's up there with Booker now. They probably have a glass in hand in heaven just at this very moment.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
He was a guest at On the Menu, and he had this wonderful book on whiskeys around the world, which I guess you probably have a copy.
Yes, sir. I've got a copy of Michael's book. Yeah, he's up there with Dad. I'm sure they are enjoying way more than their fair share of the angels' share of the, you know, the liquor that's being evaporated. But, yeah, Michael was a good man. He was a very good friend of the bourbon industry and actually all the whiskey industry. He, He did a lot to promote whiskey, educate people. And that's what we're all out here to do today. I mean, we're here to educate people on these products we produce, you know, teach them how to enjoy them, what they're all about. And, you know, and hopefully down the road when they go in their local establishment, they'll try one. And that's, you know, and Michael was a big help. A lot of good authors out there as well that are helping educate the public on the products we produce and how to enjoy them, you know, and how they're to be served.
Well, we're going to go quiet in just a second, and then we're going to close the interview down because Fred and I, we're going to toast.
Yes, sir.
Michael and Booker.
We're going to do it. We're going to have a little taste just for those two. We might have to have two, one for each one of them. What do you think?
Sounds fine to me. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
It was my pleasure. Anytime. Come to Kentucky.
I cut Fred off there. He was going to say, of course, come to Kentucky. And I suppose we will. And I'm betting you probably
you
will, too.
You had a great time, Andrew.
I did.
Now, I prefer, I have to admit, and what was that scotch we discovered, I believe? Of course, my favorite is always Lafroy. But then
well,
I found that 15-year-old Highland something.
It was 18-year-old Highland Park.
I loved it.
We read about Highland Park in a recent rating. The rater said, it's really not incorrect of me to put two whiskies from the same supplier in my favorite 20 because they're both good enough to be there. And we tried a few more as well, and it was a good time. But the highlight, I think, was talking to Fred getting his insight as to what the bourbon business is really all about. It's really simple, and it's really sort of a family business, except that of course they sold out to a major brand. Just a few years ago, but he's still running things, and I'm sure the product will continue on. And there's another the fourth coming right after him as well.
I didn't know that.
But anyway, back to
do know it's time to take a break.
Oh, it is.
Yes.
Oh, we forgot that.
No, that's what it is.
It's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station. www.aspstation.net.
And here we are, again, shifting directions just a little bit. I mean, the next up, it's still classified as liquid, I would think, but you don't really drink it. It's an architectural icon called Falling Water, and we have a book written by a friend of ours, and interviewing. Well, we might as well just go to the interview it all out.
I guess it's fair to say, if you've never heard of Falling Water, but you'd have heard of the railroad runs through the middle of the house, in the case of Falling Water, the water runs through the middle of the house. And that's just a part of the fascinating story of someone who cooked for the family, which owned and weekended at Falling Water in Western Pennsylvania for many years. And an old friend of On the Menus just completed and published a book all about that.
Suzanne Martinson, it's always wonderful talking to an old friend. How have you been?
Well, I've been wonderful, Anne. It's great talking to you again, too. We've been doing some interviews and signings for our new cookbook, the Falling Water Cookbook.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, since that's what we're talking about.
Well, that's what we're going to be talking about.
That's what we're going to be talking about.
Suzanne is retired as a food editor for the Post-Gazette and previously the press, right, Suzanne?
That's correct.
And, you put in your years of duty here, and you're now playing around by writing cookbooks.
Yeah, well, I call it a kind of a long pregnancy, and there were quite a few labor pains along the way, but we finally have it finished.
Well, it's a beautiful book, and how long did it take you finally? I remember you talking about this years ago.
Well, you know, I met Elsie Henderson when I was doing a story about her for the Pittsburgh Press in about 91, the story appeared, maybe 92, and we started to have lunch and became friends, and finally one day she said, you know, I've always wanted to write a cookbook, but I don't really know how to go about it. So I said, well, heck, I'll write it for you.
And because you knew a lot about it.
Never knowing how much was involved. And so she kept reminding me, you know, I'm 79, she said. I'm 83. I'm 87. I'm 90, Suzanne. I'm 90. When are we going to have this cookbook? So finally, she's 95 years old, and we have it. And she's doing great, and the cookbook's doing great, too. In fact, she was in downtown Pittsburgh recently, and somebody yelled across the street, said, "You go, girl."
Oh, isn't that wonderful?
And she's still going at 95. And Suzanne, you said, what did she say to you the other day? 95?
She said, we went to a big party, a big launch for the book at Henry and Elsie Hillman's place. It was called The Two Elsies. And I said, "Well, are you pretty tired, Elsie?" I called her the next day, and she said, "Well, I'm not. I'm feeling good. In fact, I think 95 is the new 7.
Well, let's step back a little bit. I mean, I can't imagine that anybody in the world would not know Falling Water. But I bet
there are people who don't.
So tell us what about Falling Water itself.
Well, Falling Water is the beautiful vacation home in western Pennsylvania that reinvigorated architect Frank Lloyd Wright's career. It is cantilevered over Bear Run Stream, and it just seems to grow out of banks, out of the rocks there. And it is a mystical, magical place. There's all those beautiful trees. There's the stream flowing under the house, and you can walk from the living room right down into the stream. In fact, Elsie had kind of an interesting experience on her very first day of work in 1947.
Tell us that. I mean, I read the book, I have to admit, but tell our listeners.
Well, she was 33 years old, and she'd just been hired as the weekend cook for the Edgar and Lillian Kaufman family and their son, Edgar Jr. And she heard some laughing and splashing, and she looked out her kitchen window, and there under the falls were Edgar and Lillian and several guests, dark nude. So she thought, what have I gotten myself into? It's a nudist camp.
Yeah.
But she stayed on and said it was the best job she ever had.
Now, they must have been pretty hardy people, because I don't think the water of Bear Run would have been very warm.
No, it's a pretty chilly stream for sure. Elsie experienced the stream in another day when she worked first for the parents until they passed away, and then she worked for the son. And she and the son were there for one weekend when a flood struck, and the water was pouring through the house, and Edgar said, "Elsie, I've got the ham." And Elsie said, "Well, at lunch you told me it was too salt." And he said, "Well, that was then, this is now."
Oh,
so they had the ham, and they ran upstairs to the guest quarters away from the water. It took several months to clear up,
clean up
the house. But it was structurally sound.
Well, now, you know, this book is more than a cookbook. It's a history of a place and a time, a whole different way of life. And it was new for Elsie, too. And it's a portrait of her, who is an amazing woman. Tell us a little bit about her.
Well, Elsie is a wonderful person. She has quite a sense of humor. She's very assertive and speaks her mind, although she will tell you that she knew how far to go when she talked to Richard.
She's African-American.
Yes, she is.
Petite.
And she actually learned to cook from her mother and always liked to be in the kitchen. At one time she thought about being a nurse, but then she decided she liked brioche better than blood, I guess. So,
but she was very diminutive also.
Yes, she's just as slim and nice looking as she ever was. She actually cooked for Frank Lloyd Wright only one time, and they drove through the college district of Pittsburgh, and he insulted the Cathedral of Learning by saying it was the biggest keep off the grass sign he'd ever seen.
Right.
Wasn't modern enough for him. But Elsie appealed to him. He took one look at her and said, "Well, if you cook as good as you look, we're going to be okay." So they got along just fine.
Oh, that's great.
Now we're talking here about someone who was the cook. So she produced only a portion of the diet of the Kaufman family and their guests, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. The butler actually did many of the meat dishes.
Now, why is that, Suzanne? I didn't really know that was usually happening.
Well, I don't know. It seemed like an odd thing, but when Mrs. Kaufman hired her, she said, "Really, I mostly would want somebody to do my baking,"
uh-huh,
because the butler/chef cooked on the grill. And she did the side dishes. She did breakfast and lunch salads. You know, the Kaufmans had everything from scratch. They didn't eat store-bought bread. They didn't eat store-bought dressings. They had homemade dressing. Gardner's wife put up preserves for them. In fact, they were kind of an early farm-to-table
movement. Very advanced. I noticed that.
Very interesting. Mr. Kaufman was kind of a gentleman farmer, and Elsie told about driving out in the countryside, and it really is in the country, in the winter, and seeing those little sheep up on the hill, little lambs frolic. They had beef cattle. They had a whole herd of Jersey cows with that very rich. So there's a recipe for peach ice cream made from that wonderful rich milk. There's lamb recipes. There's beef recipes. Of course, the dogs ate just about as well as the people.
Oh, they were in love with their dogs. And the
dachshunds. Mrs. Kaufman loved her long-haired dachshunds. They ate Swiss premium meat, and Elsie would cook them bacon and eggs for breakfast, and they had poached fish on Friday evenings. They were quite the pampered dogs. They had custom-made Stearns and Foster mattresses, so they spread hair all over, but, you know, they had the run of the place.
Well, you did a fantastic job in this. Explain the divisions of it. I mean, you give the history, and then you give Elsie's recipes, which must have been difficult, but you always preface it with her memories and her stories.
Yes. Well, Elsie has a wonderful memory, but like many great cooks, she just mostly had a list of ingredients, and then her directions were very spare. So as a former food editor, I knew we had to give a few more directions than just, like my grandma would say, bake as any cookie, you know? So I expanded the recipe directions. In fact, sometimes I would be in the middle of testing a recipe and call her on the phone and say, well, what is this bread dough supposed to look like? Is it supposed to be sticky or soft or whatever? Her breads are absolutely, her mother's potato rolls, wonderful, and she did a very fun thing with cinnamon rolls in flower pots that were just great.
Oh, yes, you have pictures of that. And the photography is beautiful in this book, too, Suzanne.
Yeah, we're real proud of the book because it's really, truly a Pittsburgh book. In fact, it's published by the University of Pittsburgh Press, who were just wonderful to work with.
Now, in order Suzanne, go ahead.
The photographers, too, were local. Rob Long and Linda Mitzel were the photographers on the book. So we took some pictures on site at Falling Water, and then we took some studio shots. And we had what I thought of in the conception of the book was Falling Water then and now. So the then recipes were the ones that Elsie had served at Falling Water, and the now recipes were done by Chef Robert Sendall of All in Good Taste Productions. And he had done a lot of catering work and party planning out at Falling Water. In fact, he prepared the lunch for Edgar Jr.'s funeral or memorial.
Oh, yeah.
So there's, and his recipes are a bit more upscale, a little bit more complex, his and Jane's recipes.
Yes,
but
the other.
Still doable for the home cook. In fact, they even included full menus that you could just pick up, one for fall, winter, different menus for people that are worried about, does this really go with this? So they did a lot of great entertaining.
Yeah, that's Jane Citrin, the late Jane Citrin.
Yes.
Yes, and Bob Sendell. Well, I think you all should be proud of this book. It's really wonderful. And you said it's University of Pittsburgh Press, and
uh-huh.
Do we have this listed on our website?
Yeah, I think you can get it at Amazon. I'm pretty sure I put it on the website.
Yeah, it can be at Amazon, and it also has a very nice play on the University of Pittsburgh Press site, and it's one of three books that they're promoting for Pittsburgh's 250th birthday.
Oh, that's great.
So we're real proud to have that, and it's really, truly a Pittsburgh product. I'm sorry that the Kaufman's name came down. I think Mr. Kaufman would certainly approved of selling the book at the Kaufman's.
Oh, yeah, with this great book Kaufman. Department, I remember it well.
Yeah, it was a great, great department
right.
store.
Anyhow, Suzanne, again, it's just wonderful talking to you, and I'm so pleased that your book is doing well. It's in its second printing, I understand.
Yes.
And it's just going gangbusters. What's not to like? I mean, your writing is wonderful as always. It's the monument itself, Falling Water, I think, is on, where is it now on the list of places you have to visit.
Yes, the food, 20 places to go before you die.
Exactly, something like that. Elsie is a wonderful character, and the recipes work. So this is a great thing.
They actually do work. In fact, one of my favorite recipes, even though I'm a great chocolate fan, as was Mr. Kaufman, Elsie always kids me, you white people like chocolate. She does not particularly like chocolate. But one of my favorite recipes in the book is her clove cake, which has shocking ingredients, which is to say it has 1 tablespoon of clove. I have never in my life made a cake or anything with more than 1/4 teaspoon. So I said, we have to write on the bottom, this is correct. It is 1 tablespoon of clove. But it blends with the 1 tablespoon of cinnamon. And you know what, Anne? It's good enough to eat for breakfast.
Oh, well, that sounds good to me.
There you go. Well, Suzanne, continue in your happy diamond out there in the West, I think you are. And if you have another project coming up that you'd like us to know about, well, you be sure to let us know.
Well, I feel so pleased and honored to be invited to be on your show.
Well, we miss you, so stay in touch.
And we certainly miss Pittsburgh. We really still think of it as our hometown.
So listeners, it's called The Falling Water Cookbook. You can get it through the OTM bookshelf, and it's something that ought to be on your bookshelf.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thanks, Suzanne.
Okay.
Bye.
Well, we filled another hour or so, more or less.
We didn't just fill an hour. I learned
a lot with all these interviews.
Yeah, we hope you found it an informative and interesting program. And, of course, we'll expect you to join us again, same time, same place, next week.
Bye-bye.